Then Sholem Aleichem died. Some 43 years ago, in May of 1916, in the city of New York, hundreds of thousands of Jews turned out for his funeral. Seldom has any writer, Jew or non-Jew, been so honored. Simple folk who followed the funeral procession wept as if they had lost a very dear and intimate friend. This month, which marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Sholem Aleichem. He was born in 1859. This month is being commemorated by the entire Jewish world. And even in the Soviet Union, where Jewish, Yiddish writings and writers have not been held in particularly high repute. Even in the Soviet Union, his centenary is being observed with the friendly approval of the government. And a new edition of his works, short stories, novels, plays, some 35 to 40 volumes, a new edition of his works has been published in the Soviet Union. And during the lifetime of Sholem Aleichem, and since his death, his writings have been translated into numerous languages, including Japanese and Esperanto. He has been likened to Cervantes, famous author of Don Quixote, to Charles Dickens, to Mark Twain. Now, who is this writer who has been known far and wide by his pen name, Sholem Aleichem, which means peace to you, or as we would say, hello, although Sholem Aleichem is not hello. It carries with it much more. Whence is his great and lasting appeal to all people, even to those who do not understand the Yiddish language in which Sholem Aleichem wrote? What is his great appeal? The world about which he wrote has since vanished almost completely. The language in which he wrote, which in his day was spoken by some 10, 12 million Jews, is known today, I am afraid, to less than a fifth of that number. Evidently, like all great art, there is something perennial and universal in the stories and in the types and characters of Sholem Aleichem's writings. Something which lives above and beyond time and place, which ensure him immortality in mankind's literary pantheon. Solomon Rabinowitz, for that was his real name, was born in a rather small city in southern Russia, 100 years ago. In many ways, the life of Eastern European Jewry in those days, and they represented the center and the core of the Jewish people throughout the world, numerically speaking. In many ways, the life of Eastern European Jewry in Sholem Aleichem's day was still medieval, but new winds had begun to blow through the ghetto. Tsarist tyranny was still pressing down very heavily upon the people. They lived in a Pale of Settlement, hemmed in. Their lives were insecure. Many occupations were close to them. They lived in constant dread of hostile decrees and of ruthless government officials. And it was not long before violent pogroms broke out in that Pale of Settlement, which drove the masses of the people to despair and sent them in headlong flight to other countries, and especially to America, which to them was the golden land of opportunity. Jewish life was still within the framework of Orthodox traditional Judaism. It was still largely controlled by the detailed provision of the Shulchan Aruch, the rabbinic code of Jewish practice for all occasions which regulated Jewish life. The Cheder, the elementary school, and the yeshiva, the higher rabbinic seminary, had changed but very little through the centuries in content or in method, and their curricula of instruction included very little of the learning and the sciences of the New Age. Nevertheless, that world in which Sholem Aleichem was born 100 years ago was no longer a static world. Here and there, and in the larger cities, the Jews were reaching out for the enlightenment and the education and the opportunities of the free world, which they knew to exist beyond the borders of the Pale of Settlement of Russia, and were reaching out for the revolutionary ideas of human freedom and basic human rights. Some, like Sholem Aleichem himself, were not satisfied anymore with learning Hebrew in the Cheder. They began to study the Russian language, and that helped them to look beyond their limited horizons into a new world. Some of them were frequently joining revolutionary political movements and were working for the overthrow of the Tsarist regime. And others were escaping altogether the Pale of Settlement and were making their way westward to the schools and the universities of the Western world and to the New World, which had begun to beckon to them, the golden land of America. Now, Sholem Aleichem was the product of this world in the Pale of the Russian Jewish settlement. His early life was spent in a small, old-fashioned town in Poltava, southern Russia, near Kiev, Voronkov, which he later immortalized in his writings as Kasrilivke, and which he himself described as a small town of little people. Sholem Aleichem was the product of the Cheder, but he also, as I said, learned Russian. His father was a maskil, one of the intellectual Jews, who believed in giving his children as much of a modern education as he could. In fact, at the age of 17, Sholem Aleichem was supporting himself by giving private lessons in Russian And one of his pupils, the young daughter of a very rich Jewish landowner, with one of his pupils he fell in love. And later on, against the violent opposition of her father, they were married. Shalom Aleichem, as a young man, was bright and gay and light-hearted, bent on all kind of innocent mischief. He loved to poke fun at people, to make them the butt of merriment, but never with any malice, never with any bitterness. When his father-in-law died, the father of this young pupil of Shalom Aleichem, married. When his father-in-law died, Shalom Aleichem became the administrator of the estate of this rich Jew, an estate which amounted in those days to ₹250,000, which was a substantial fortune in those days. But Shalom Aleichem began to trade on the grain exchange and the stock exchange, and soon lost his fortune. And he never came within sight of so much money again the rest of his life. Most of his life he lived very modestly, but in actual straitened circumstances. And toward the end of his life in New York City in the Bronx, he was an unsuccessful insurance agent and could not make a living. In one of the famous galaxy of portraits of Kastrilivke, which Shalom Aleichem so skillfully and artistically depicted, there is one character, Menachem Mendel, a Luftmensch, and that term Luftmensch was coined by Shalom Aleichem. A man who looks up in the air all the time, with his feet never on the ground. A speculator. And who has amazing plans in his mind. A man who tries 1,001 occupations, but never makes a cent. A Luftmensch, a speculator, always in a hurry. Menachem Mendel was a speculator, a broker, a real estate agent, a dealer in timber, in mines, in oil, and whatnot. And in that character which Shalom Aleichem drew, Menachem Mendel, one can find a very sly self-criticism of himself. As Shalom Aleichem's fame grew as a writer, and he began writing very early, he traveled throughout the Pale of Jewish settlement in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, and read his stories. He was a very skillful reader of his own writings, and he became extremely popular. And he traveled to Galicia, to Western Europe, and everywhere he was warmly received by the masses of the people who loved his stories. When the pogroms of 1905 broke in Russia, Shalom Aleichem left Europe, came to the United States, and here too he was received with open arms by a great following of people. But he remained in this country only a short time. He couldn't acclimatize himself to the new world, and he returned to Europe. And there he traveled about, writing, reading his stories, trying to earn a living. His health was not of the best. He spent some time in Italy. Then when the First World War broke out, he again returned to the United States. And here for a time he did well as a writer of one of the Jewish newspapers, but after a time he lost a contract with that newspaper, and as I indicated a moment ago, the remaining months of his life were spent in relative poverty, in spite of the great adulation in which he was held, which was given to him by the masses of the people. And he died, as I said, in 1916. Shalom Aleichem took to writing very early in life. He was 17 when he began to write. And his first writing was in Hebrew, not in Yiddish. And that is true of nearly all of Jewish writers. But Hebrew was the language of the intellectual. It was the respectable language, classical language. And while everybody spoke Yiddish, when they came to write, to compose a book, they wrote in Hebrew. Yiddish was the common speech of the masses, the mameloshim. It was the vernacular. It was not as high-placed as Hebrew. And while Jews had been speaking Yiddish for hundreds of years, ever since the Jews of Germany first adopted it in the Middle Ages, it had never displaced Hebrew as the language of study, or of worship, or of literary composition. And that, of course, is true, if you recall, also of the German language itself, and of nearly all the Romance languages of Europe. They could not displace Latin as the language of scholarship, and learning, and writing, the language of culture and education until comparatively recent times. But around the middle of the 19th century, Yiddish began to come into its own. And three great masters, three great writers, were responsible. The first one was the famous writer Abramowitz Mendele Mechosforim, Mendele the bookseller. The second one, of course, was Isaac Leib Peretz. And the third was Shalom Aleichem himself. It was they who made Yiddish a very respectable, a very effective language of literature. These writers, Abramowitz, Peretz, Shalom Aleichem, soon found that if they wished to reach the masses of the Jewish people, and not merely the intellectual classes, with their message or their social criticism, they had to employ Yiddish, which was understood by everybody, as their means of expression and of communication. And Shalom Aleichem's style soon captivated large sections of European, Eastern European Jewry. It was folksy, lively, richly idiomatic, easy-flowing, yet very artful, very cunningly wrought. And the style revealed how colorful and how flexible and how perfectly adequate was this so-called jargon, this ugly duckling of a dialect Yiddish could be. And people loved his style, and people loved the people about whom Shalom Aleichem wrote. Themselves. He wrote about themselves. Their life. Their life as they knew it, their environment, an environment which was made doubly revealing to them because of the skillful artistry of Shalom Aleichem. He wrote about their hopes and their foibles and their suffering. He wrote about Kasrilivke, their shtetl, their little town, the people they knew, familiar faces, all of them. And they loved Shalom Aleichem for the way he wrote about them. He did not laugh at them. He laughed with them. He did not mock or deride them, as others have done or could easily do. He did not make sport of them. He knew the unseemly side of their lives, he knew all that was grotesque and all that was absurd. And he did not withhold his pen from writing about it, but he understood also the why and the wherefore of things as they were. What went before, what went on of poverty and misery and oppression. And so he did not hold them up to ridicule. He was one of them. They felt that he was one of them. And he included himself in all the sly, compassionate humor which he directed at his fellow citizens of Kasrilivka, and he could weep with them. He was their brother, their big brother, perhaps a more understanding brother, but a brother all the time. Shalom Aleichem himself describes the city of Kastrilivka, and I want to read you a paragraph or two, give you perhaps a taste of his style, and of his approach to the subject and to the people about whom he wrote. He calls it the town of the little people. He was always interested in little people. The big people didn't interest him. They had other people. They could look after themselves. The town of the little people into which I shall now take you, dear reader, is exactly in the middle of the blessed pale, the pale of settlement, into which Jews have been packed as closely as herring in a barrel and told to increase and multiply. The name of the town is Kastrilivka. How did this name originate? I'll tell you. Among us Jews, poverty has many faces and many aspects. A poor man is an unlucky man. He's a pauper, he's a beggar, he's a schnorrer, he's a starveling, a tramp, or a plain failure. All kinds of names for a poor man. A different tone is used in speaking of each one, but all these names express human wretchedness. However, there is still another name, Kasril, or Kasrilik. That name is spoken in a different tone altogether, almost a bragging tone. For instance, oh, am I ever a Kasrilik? A Kasrilik is not just an ordinary pauper, a failure in life. On the contrary, he is a man who has not allowed poverty to degrade him. He laughs at it, he is poor, but cheerful. Stuck away in a corner of the world, isolated from the surrounding country, the town stands, orphaned, dreaming, bewitched, immersed in itself, and remote from the noise and bustle, the confusion and tumult and greed, which men have created about them and have dignified with high-sounding names like culture and progress and civilization. A proper person may take off his hat with respect to these things, but not these little people. Not only do they know nothing of automobiles and modern travel and airplanes, for a long time they refused to believe in the existence of the old ordinary railroad train altogether. They refused to believe in its existence. Such a thing could not be, they said. Why, they said, it's a dream, a fairy tale. You might just as well talk of a merry-go-round in heaven. But it happened once that a householder of Kastrilivka had to go to Moscow. When he came back, he swore with many oaths that it was true. There was a railroad. He himself had ridden in a train to Moscow, and it had taken him, he shrugged his shoulders, less than 1 hour. This the little people interpreted to mean that he had ridden less than an hour and then walked the rest of the way. But still, the fact of the train remained. If a Jew and a householder of Kastrilivka swore to it, they could not deny that there was such a thing as a train. It had to be true. He could not have invented it out of thin air. He even explained to them the whole miracle of the train and drew a diagram on the paper. He showed them how the wheels turned, the smokestack whistled, the carriage flew. People rode to Moscow. The little people of Kastrilivka listened, nodded their heads solemnly, and deep in their hearts they laughed at him. What a story. The wheels turn, smokestack whistles, carriages fly, people ride to Moscow and then come back again. That's how they all are, these little people. None of them are gloomy. None of them are worried little men of affairs. But on the contrary, they're known everywhere as jesters, storytellers, a cheerful, light-hearted breed of men. Poor, but cheerful. It's hard to say what makes them so happy. Nothing. Just sheer joy of living. Living? If you ask them, how do you live? They will answer with a shrug and a laugh, how do we live? Who knows? We live. A remarkable thing. Whenever you meet them, they are scurrying like rabbits. This one here, that one there. They never have time to stop. What are you hurrying for? What am I hurrying for? Well, it's like this. If we hurry, we think that we might run into something. Earn a few pennies. Provide for the Sabbath. Provide for the Sabbath. To provide for the Sabbath, that is their goal in life. All week they labor and sweat, wear themselves out, live without food or drink, just so there is something for the Sabbath. And when the Holy Sabbath arrives, let Yehupetz perish. Yehupetz is the name for Kiev, it's a big city. Let Yehupetz perish, let Odessa be razed, let Paris itself sink into the earth. Kasrilivka lives. And this is a fact, that since Kasrilivka was founded, no Jew had gone hungry there on the Sabbath. Is it possible that there is a Jew who does not have fish for the Sabbath? If he has no fish, then he has meat. If he has no meat, then he has herring. If he has no herring, then he has white bread. If he has no white bread, then he has black bread and onions. If he has no black bread and onions, then he borrows some from his neighbor. Next week, the neighbor will borrow from him. The world is a wheel, and it keeps turning. And the Kasrilivka repeats this maxim and shows you with his hand how it turns. To him, a maxim, a witty remark, is everything. For an apt remark, he will forsake his mother and father, as the saying goes. The tales you hear about these little people sound fabulous, but you may be sure they're all true. For instance, there is the story of the Kasrilivkite who got tired of starving in Kasrilivka and went out into the wide world to seek his fortune. He left the country, wandered far and wide, and finally reached Paris. There, naturally, he wanted to see the Rothschilds. For how can a Jew come to Paris and not visit the Rothschilds? Well, they didn't let him in. What's the trouble, he wants to know. Your coat is torn, they tell him. You fool, says the Jew. If I had a good coat, would I have gone to Paris? It looked hopeless. But a Kasrilivkite never gives up. He thought a while, and then he said to the doorman, tell your master that it isn't an ordinary beggar who has come to his door, but a Jewish merchant who has brought him a piece of goods such as you can't find in Paris for any amount of money. Hearing this, Rothschild became curious and asked what the merchant had brought in, and asked that the merchant be brought in. Shalom Aleichem, said Rothschild. Aleichem Shalom, said the merchant. Take a seat. Where do you come from? I come from Kasrilivka. What good news do you bring? Well, Mr. Rothschild, they say in our town that you are not so badly off. If I had only half of what you own, or only a third, you would still have enough left. And honors, I imagine, you don't lack either. But people always look up to a man of riches. And what do you lack? One thing only, to live forever, eternal life. And that is what I've come to send you. When Rothschild heard this, he said, well, let's get down to business. What will it cost me? It will cost you, and here the man stopped to consider, it will cost you 300 rubles. Is that your best price? My very best. I could have said a lot more than 300, but I said it, so it's final. Rothschild said no more, counted out the 300 rubles, one by one, and now Kasrilivka slipped the money into his pocket and said to Rothschild, if you want to live forever, my advice to you is to leave this noisy, busy Paris and move to our town of Kasrilivka. There you can never die, because since Kasrilivka has been a town, no rich man has ever died there. Shalom Aleichem brought cheer to an oppressed and distraught generation of Jews. His purpose was never to hurt, but always to heal. He was not a reformer. He was not a moralist. He was not reproving or chastising or exposing the evils which an ordinary, loveless satirist might have done. Whatever criticism he had to offer, he always offered in the form of a capsule of good humor. Someone summed up the message of Sholem Aleichem to his generation in these words. You take the world too seriously. You think more of it than it is worth. You demand more of it than it can give. The things you complain of are really trifles. If you looked at them from a proper distance, you would see that there is more to laugh than to cry over. You are justly displeased with the world. But there is something that transcends justice. It is mercy. You are a pessimist because of your overabundant optimism. You think that the world deserves to be rebuked. All it really deserves is to be forgiven. I wish I had time to tell you more about Sholem Aleichem, some of his amazing characters. But then you must read him yourself. Sholem Aleichem should be read rather than talked about. And many of his works are available in English translation. Sholem Aleichem loved his people. They loved him, not only for his humor, but for his humanity. He loved children greatly. He wrote some of the loveliest children's stories in Yiddish literature, or for that matter, in all literature. He loved the common people. And in his last will and testament, he wrote, "No matter where I die, I am to be buried not among aristocrats, men of high lineage, or men of great wealth, but among common Jewish workmen with just ordinary folk, so that the tombstone to be put on my grave will honor the ordinary graves around mine, and the ordinary graves will honor my tombstone in the way in which the plain, honest people honor their folk writer in his lifetime." And so it came to be. Sholem Aleichem found his last resting place in the Arbeiterring Cemetery in Brooklyn, but he also found his last resting place in the hearts of his people everywhere throughout the world.